Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Welcome to episode
50-ish.
It's like 52, yeah. Somewhere around there. I don't know. Of Jilluminati Podcast, I am always one of your hosts, Mike Martin, joined by my other two co-hosts, Alex Fasciani. Hello, sir.
I'm also always one of your hosts.
You are also always one of my hosts. And then, honestly, I think the only one we've done one episode where Jesse wasn't here.
What do you mean?
I think it was episode 3.5. There was an episode where you were traveling very early on, and
yeah,
me and Alex
like
did
out
a
of country or something. I can't remember what it was.
Yeah,
and so I'm ashamed that I let you two run rampant with one episode, even if it was a 0.5 episode. How dare I?
That was the 5G.
How dare
episode.
I let the community down? The 5G episode. Well, yeah. That's obviously true. So
we can only cover such truths when you are away.
Right. Of course. Yeah.
Oh God, I'm super pumped for this episode today, gentlemen. I have to say. I know I said this is Skinwalker. Going into this is like double the amount of research, double the amount of time put into this. Today, we're talking about the start, at the very least, of Roswell.
The holiest of holies.
It's the beginning of a lot of things. If we ever want to do more alien things that are more niche, you really have to cover Roswell and the two crashes around that area, because this is a lot of people's introduction to MJ-12, to even what grays are as a whole. This is kind of where it all bubbles up. And so I want to start, you know, I'm excited to start this multi-parter, this giant journey, but we couldn't do it without Deanna. Deanna, thank you. We're talking 4 books of research. We're going to go over our sources here in a minute, but I got to pitch it off to Alex first, because there would be no Deanna if there was no Patreon.
That's right.
Oh, we're still doing this?
That's right. And if you, we can't afford it, but if you can imagine In the Arms of an Angel playing under this, please, if you love this show, reach into your hearts and help us out with a few dollars a month, whatever you can afford, because you are enabling us to have weekly episodes. Problems. You are enabling us to have professionally done research. Right, and now you are able to eventually get all of us together in a very scary place to do something that we haven't really figured out yet. So if that sounds tied to you and you love minisodes, head on over to patreon.com/chilluminatipod, where you can also
you're going to get all that research as well, so you can see what you're paying for.
All that research.
A lot of it.
All of it.
Notes. All that research.
My notes have, like, my jokes in them, too.
They do. Funny. They actually have the jokes
written
in.
Yeah, so if you ever want to see how crazy I am, just read my notes.
I don't like that. You have joke notes?
Not, like, every joke that I say is in there, but, like, you know, I like to have a...
Bits. Little fun bits.
Yes. I like to have a vibe of levity when I tell the story, because I don't want people to fuck up and actually take it totally serious. You know? You get
Unlike today's episode, where I want you to take this deathly seriously.
Mount Chilmore desecrating the Black Hills of South Dakota. On it, you would see a flying saucer to represent Roswell, New Mexico, the George Washington, who is not on Mount Rushmore. He's been replaced by a big alien with big eyes, and he's there. And
what? Wait, so your Mount Rushmore is a crashed UFO.
Yeah. Yeah. I can see it in the side lodged.
It's like a crashed UFO, but instead of like a face, it's crashed into like, you know, like a big alien's face, like the one from the autopsy video.
Sure.
So in this timeline, we had to do
an alien. An alien. All right. What are the other three?
Big
Teddy Roosevelt is replaced by Mothman, obviously.
Yeah. Yeah. Mothman's obviously got to be up
Jefferson
there.
Jefferson is Bigfoot. And,
okay, yeah. And, so who's Lincoln?
See, Lincoln should be Bigfoot. I don't know.
Just because of the beard? Just
yeah, of the beard? Big head, should the be hairy Bigfoot. Face, you know?
He's a little bit more associated with the outdoors. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, then Jefferson. Who's Jefferson?
Who is the smiling man, injured cold?
I feel like he has to be one of the, like, some sort of sea creature.
Well, what about the Loch Ness Monster?
Well, is that an American thing,
though? Oh, okay. All right. I didn't realize that the Mount Chilmore was the American cryptid.
It's the American version, okay. Please. What if it's just a thing representing the Bermuda Triangle?
Just a big ass
like face.
Just a triangle.
Just a triangle?
Just a triangle, and it's just a giant airplane black box. with a thermometer in its mouth and a handkerchief around its head like it's got a fever from the 1920s.
Mm-hmm. I like it. I like
great.
It.
Done. Perfect.
Fan art, please.
Nailed it.
No, the Boston Bean Boy's got to get up there at some point. He's
can
just
we
up the
shout
top
out
somewhere.
To all yeah, the fucking we? Incredible like comic book quality Boston Bean Boy fucking art that we
need
got.
To keep this going. Boston Bean Boy art. We need to, if we can get a Wikipedia page on like some sort of paranormal website.
There's
or
a
like,
cryptid
there's
version
a wiki
of Wikipedia,
for,
so.
Yeah, if we can start making that, but don't reference this podcast at all, please.
Yeah, yeah. If you think Shepard Fairey is out there listening to episodes of Chilluminati, we want the Boston Bean Boy to be the next Andre the Giant. Like, let's get that BBB, you know,
Boston Baked Bean Boy. BBBB.
The Boston Baked Bean Boy?
Yeah, that's how he is.
B4.
Because he steals,
yeah,
he steals your
baked,
legal nugs.
He's stealing nugs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Legal nugs.
Legal nugs.
Legal nugs.
He's only in the states where it's legal.
Yeah.
And he, we need to just get him out there, keep talking about him. We definitely need a shirt.
Yeah, we're going
to
get some merch.
We need people out there to just reference him in conversation.
And if somebody
like, oh,
could,
yeah, like the Boston Baked Bean Boy.
If somebody could see him, that would be great.
Yeah, yeah, you can, you know, just yeah. spot him
if
somewhere.
You can somehow get shaky camera footage of the Boston Baked Bean Boy getting your legal nugs, that would be great.
This is what you back you know, and fund
you know
on Patreon.
The alien in the driveway? The alien that's like walking.
The one that looks like Dobby?
Yeah. The wobbly leg one.
You get a Boston Baked Bean Boy in the driveway.
Slapping on down the block.
Oh my god, dude. I love this stupid fucking this is what you fund at Patreon. Thank you everybody. This is the best. We're definitely get some merch up for the Boston Baked Bean Boy. We got Schlorp merch coming. Keep your eyes out.
How far have we fallen? What won't
or how high have we ascended, gentlemen?
I'm the Patreon guy and I'm disgusted by our own market savvy at this point.
Is it market
Boston
savvy?
Boston Baked Bean Boy needs a shirt. I'd wear that shirt proudly.
Me too, dude. Are you kidding me?
He has to say legalize
I, again.
It.
Yeah.
He does not.
No, that's what he's shouting. He's yelling it.
He's in a speech bubble
no.
next to him. Legalize it! Or
we
no,
need,
he sounds
no.
like John F. Kennedy. Legalize it.
We need to, on this shirt, we can't have it related to this podcast. Oh. The shirt needs to say, I went to Boston and all I saw was the Bean Boy. So we yeah. need like a shirt that looks like you bought it at a Boston tourist shop.
I agree.
I bought legal
I like
weed in Boston and it got stolen by the Boston Baked Bean Boy.
Yeah, like that. Yes. Oh, man.
Yes.
Yes.
We need that.
Okay.
Have you seen my weed?
We need to tap an artist. We got to hire somebody to whip up a little art, and that's what we need to do.
We need to not have any reference to this podcast. We need to start this grassroots where in 20 years from now, people are like, I saw them. I saw them out on the street stealing sweet, sweet nugs. I know. I know this is happening.
I knew it was him because they were legal nugs.
All right. Thank you guys for allowing us to do our nonsense. We have to divert into the more serious stuff now. Roswell, New Mexico. First, we want to acknowledge our sources for those who like to read along in the book club, both in and out of the Discord. If you like to read along with us, we have four major books that we used for research here. The first one is Crash at Corona, the U.S. Military Retrieval and Cover-Up, the 2004 edition specifically. The authors of this are Don Berliner and Stanton Friedman. Don Berliner has been a longtime journalist, aviation historian, been writing full-time for 30 years, has been a newspaper reporter and photographer, assistant editor, Capitol Hill correspondent, a bunch of other stuff. Stanton Friedman actually has his Master's of Science in Nuclear Physics. He was employed by a bunch of high-end places like Aerojet, General Nucleonics, General
now
Mortars.
Now spends most of his time on Coast to Coast AM.
And then in 1970, he went and pursued the scientific investigation of UFOs full-time.
USO's
different, totally different.
They're doing
entirely
something,
different.
I tell you. They're bringing all those people around the world.
How can they do it?
How can they do it all in one night?
Only with a UFO. Also, the other books, The Roswell Incident, the classic study of UFO contacts. This is particularly used for interviews. This book is basically just a compilation of interviews of people around that time. Then we've got UFO Crash at Roswell. We use that for research and a bunch of articles and whatnot. We're not going to go into the details, but if you want the books, those three books are the major sources for this bundle of episodes that you're going to get. The Roswell incident in particular is kind of like a modern day fairy tale at this point. It's a modern folklore story told to those in circles who care about that sort of shit anyway. It's an event so covered up in its own lies, deceit, backtracking of statements released, unreleased, re-released, and modified, but otherwise unchanged. There's a lot that went into the Roswell incident that makes it very confusing, even for those who believe that it was a weather balloon in the end of it all. I'm going to give my full opinion at the end of this series, but suffice to say, if this is all about a weather balloon, it's insane the lengths that they went to cover it all up. For weeks in late June, leading up to July in 1947, reports of dazzling lights, mysterious objects, and UFOs were running rampant in the area. During that time, an object of some sort crashed into a nearby sheep ranch, spreading debris over a square mile. On July 8, 1947, a press release went out to the news stations across the country. This press release, first issued by First Lieutenant Walter Haut under direct orders from Colonel William Blanchard, stated the following, and I quote, The many rumors regarding the flying disc became a reality yesterday when the intelligence office of the 509th Bomb Group of the either Air Force Roswell Army Airfield was fortunate enough to gain possession of a disc through the cooperation of one of the local ranchers in the sheriff's offices of Chaves County. The flying object landed on a ranch near Roswell sometime last week. Not having phone facilities, the rancher stored the disc until such a time as he was able to contact the sheriff's office, who in turn notified Major Jesse A. Marcel of the 509th Bomb Group Intelligence Office. Action was taken immediately, and the disc was picked up at the rancher's home. It was inspected at the Roswell Army Airfield and subsequently loaned by Major Marcel to higher headquarters. End quote. That was the report that went out.
I love that they call it a disc. That's so funny to me.
They called it a disc.
Transport the disc.
Yep. It's bizarre. However, following that crazy information and press release, not 3 hours later, another message got sent out rectifying the claim that it was not indeed a flying saucer or disc, but instead a weather balloon. While behind the scenes, while they were put that correction out, the United States Air Force packed up the remnants of this balloon into a B-29 Super Fortress flown by the 509th out of Roswell to Fort Worth with Major Marcel inside the plane. The literal exact plane that flew the A-bomb and dropped it in Japan.
The actual same plane?
The actual same plane flown by the exact same outfit, flown out of Roswell to Fort Worth with this balloon inside of it.
Is the implication that they're like a prestigious group?
It's
like
neat. So
top?
If you want to look it up, B-29 Super Fortresses, they're enormous.
That's what I was going to ask.
To make one of these things fly, it's a lot of fuel, a lot of people.
I think what Alex is asking, though, is like the crew, the reason why it's the same crew is if they could keep their mouth shut about like dropping bombs,
yes,
they could keep their mouth shut about transporting.
The idea is that we're looking at evidence that they employed the same discreet elite crew of pilots,
yes, same
who carried another precious piece of cargo, right?
Correct.
Okay.
Or just
okay.
If you want to believe it, just use that plane, that car, that crew for a weather balloon.
Right. But how big was the wreckage?
We're going to talk about all in detail what wreckage was found, how long it was kept, what the rancher Saw, all that stuff. We're going to talk all about
why you would need a super fortress. Like, that's a huge.
Yeah, it's a monster thing. Ship. It's a monstrous plane.
Google that, audience. Look how big it is.
But let me continue a little while here. Following that official story was that it was a piece of wreckage as a part of the weather balloon, what's known as a radar reflector called a Rawinsond. I think that I'm probably butchering it, but it's spelled Rawinsonde. That's what the after a day or two passed, that's what the official claim is what they picked up was a Rawinsond. So if you look that up, it's not really all that big. You can even look it up from the 40s. There's pictures of it from the 40s in case you don't want, you know, modern ones, not too different.
Oh, it's like one of those big white balloons, eh?
Yeah, more or less. So okay. It's kind of like a deflated thing.
Yeah, it's like a, it's kind of like a sort of like loosey-goosey, droopy balloon that floats sort high of. As hell up, yeah.
Yeah. General Ramey went on Fort Worth radio station, went on the Fort Worth radio station and explained things to calm things down. He also announced that he'd be on NBC to address the country later on. However, that never went through and it never happened. And that's where the story ends for most people. And that's certainly where the government forces it to end as best they can. But if one just looks a little deeper, there's a whole lot that doesn't make sense. How can something like a balloon crash into the ground so violently that it scattered its parts over a square mile? Why was the first press release under orders of a colonel speaking openly about a flying disc? Why fly the wreckage of such a simple thing on a B-29 Superfortress, the very same planes that carried the A-bomb to Japan? But over this multi-part series, we're ideally going to try and dissect that deep dive and drag everything out that we can get our hands on. And while it still might not be an actual physical alien craft, or is it? Who knows? There are plenty of other things that it could be that aren't a weather balloon. And so, I'm super excited because now it's finally time to dive into Roswell. UFO sightings, while certainly hitting peaks and valleys through the decades, have been around longer than most people believe. While in the 40s, especially UFO fever was hitting a high, we can actually look back decades and centuries, as we've talked about on the podcast many times before, and still see claims of magnificent and weird shit in the sky all the time. True, by definition, UFO sightings. In the 19th century, plenty of captains of sea vessels and astronomers would see lights in the skies that would perplex them, moving in ways that confused them. And so they deemed them remarkable meteors, as they at least knew what a meteor was and could compare them to that.
Remies.
Is that...
I'm just trying to jazz it up. Like, I feel like remarkable meteors sounds like it was invented by...
A 19th century astronomer.
Yeah, like the guys who built the dinosaurs wrong. You know what I mean? Like some kind of
not everything needs to be like jazzed up, though.
Dude, I'm just
they
saying.
They call them Remy's kids.
Is that weird? Is that Alex's purpose, though? Jazz
I'm
things up?
I'm just saying,
up,
like,
man.
Imagine you're on the radio. We're like, we have a remarkable meteor in sight. That's like, that's too much. It's a mouthful. Come on.
I mean, they didn't have radios back then.
I'm just saying, you know what I'm saying. You get what I'm saying.
All right, you know, I know what you're saying.
Wait, who didn't have radios back then? What year are you talking about?
The 19th century.
Yeah, like, oh, the olden times.
Ye
old it makes sense
captains,
why they call it.
Captain pilots and captain, like, astronomers on the seas.
Yeah.
Sure, okay, yeah,
that's
yeah.
where
okay.
we're starting. We're
all
talking
right.
about that. Yeah, there's all no right. radios. Because right. They don't need to jazz up remarkable meteors because, you know, it's very...
I mean, they had telegraphs. They could have been like, remarkable meteor, stop. Coming in, stop.
In the short late- from now on, stop.
In the late 19th Stop. Century, remarkable meteors could be like the name of a magazine. Like,
that's
like,
true.
Like remarkable meteors, true. Issue 31. Stories of the sky. Remies were seen floating over the air.
Yum.
Well, things get way more interesting as we push time a little forward. With the invention of airships, a rash of new reports were dubbed mystery airships in the sky. Think about, I think Jess even talked about it a little bit. Remember when Zeppelins and mystery Zeppelins in the sky... kind of ghost ships that flew around, that kind of thing. Those mm-hmm. were being seen more and more. But it wasn't until we had airplanes in the sky that they truly became commonplace. Mystery airplanes were all around with no explanation. And reaching the end of World War II, we saw a huge uptick in UFOs. Tell me, gentlemen, if this sounds a little familiar. Soldiers at the end of World War II were starting to report and see things known as, quote, playful balls of light that would dip, dodge through the trees, and keep just out of range of the soldiers. Other playful balls of light would also be in the sky, tagging along beside the pilots as they flew. They were, by all accounts, docile, and the suggestions for natural phenomena were your common grab bag of things like St. Elmo's fire, which is the atmospheric discharge of static electricity. Or they would hand wave it away as enemies developing new secret technology, and they were using it to test.
How would they wave it away as that? It's probably just enemies testing super secret technology. No big deal.
Well, so to me, also at the same time, like, if that's true, why are they being passive?
And why are they characterizing him as playful?
Yes, also true. Why are they calling him playful balls of light?
Or playbolas, as we call them on the Chilluminati podcast.
What? Was that another...
No comment. I should not call them that.
A playful ball of light. Playbola.
So it wasn't just the U.S. seeing it either. There were reports of all soldiers... there were reports of all kinds coming from soldiers... from all every side of the war, and they would eventually be dubbed Foo Fighters, hence the term, and that's where the band gets their name.
That's the best.
I honestly couldn't think of a Foo Fighters song, so thank you for doing something, because I just is like I don't have anything.
And I wonder,
could have gone with Learn to Fly.
Okay, yeah, there you go. Oh, what a great, that would have been a great reference right
all
there.
All I really want to ask of you, do you believe a flying saucer crashed in the New Mexico desert in 1947?
I mean, do you believe?
I'm just going to put this out there, but my father was born in 47, and I'm not saying I always thought he was an alien, but...
You are a star child.
What if I'm a star child?
You feel like it was like a Superman scenario?
Like what he if was my like dad a baby? Was Superman? Yeah, but he like wasted it on just like...
Maybe he just doesn't. Maybe he just got like. Maybe when he got exposed to yellow sun, he just like. Maybe he can just like fart really quietly. Like maybe it's just like not that big of a deal.
That has never been his power.
Okay, fair enough. I'm not on the inside on that one. I can't talk. I can't speak on that. Maybe he just like he's really good at making fall off the bone ribs. Like, you know, maybe it's just like a little. No, that's not true either.
Unfortunately, no?
I mean, I'm just throwing
them
out as examples. Like I said, I've never met the guy.
Does he have like a dad dish that he just is really good at?
I mean, he used to make like a mean salsa. Do aliens make good salsa? Is that like a thing?
I don't know.
Mean salsa. That's just like what a dad does. I make a mean salsa. It could just be tomatoes and onions, and it could be a mean salsa if your dad makes it.
Yeah, dads make mean salsas. Oh, but he would spice it up. You got to have the jalapenos.
Yeah, you got to put them in there.
And the onion, come on now. Anyway, what are we doing?
Anyway, yeah, you're making me fucking hungry, dude. I don't need to eat. beyond that.
Was there, and it's time to talk about Foo Fighters.
So Foo Fighters, that's what they dubbed them at the end of World War II. But sound familiar to Skinwalker Ranch? Just a little bit. What?
Same type of stuff. Same type of report.
Yeah, same kind of activity.
But what if we just, like, cut Skinwalker Ranch off from this discussion?
It's impossible.
I can never cut that out of
my life.
That's
why Skinwalker Ranch is the biggest scam of all.
Listen.
Because Skinwalker Ranch is everything, so every time you bring up anything, you have to be like, well, you know, like Skinwalker Ranch.
Yeah.
The marketing on Skinwalker Ranch, the team is so good. They're like, well, yeah, Bigfoot, aliens, Chupacabra, Loch Ness Monster, it's all there. Parallel Dimensions, it's all
there.
Loch
Ness Monster was not there. No one said that. Nobody saw him there.
Dozens of hours of my life into reading and researching and outlining and scripting goddamn Skinwalker Ranch. I will bring it up as many times as I want to or need to.
I'm just saying, it seems like they're trying to con... It's like the late night infomercial
where the Loch Ness Monster was hanging out with the other guy who shot JFK.
They're all there.
Everybody's there, dude. Everyone's there. Every time we cover, they go to Skinwalker Ranch after. Whatever we cover, it migrates to Skinwalker after.
You think I'm joking? That's what Skinwalker Ranch is. Let's not pretend that's what that is.
Maybe Skinwalker Ranch is like, you know, like Fables, but for cryptids and conspiracy theories.
Sure.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That'd be great.
Yeah.
That's where they, like, retire, you know? They will live together in a community.
the Skinwalker Ranch retirement community.
For cryptids.
For cryptids, yes.
And
it's so good. That's another. Write that down.
Bigsby, Bigfoot.
Yeah.
Right?
Mothman, and, obviously.
He's the detective of the town.
Mossman.
Yeah.
Mossman. He's
you obviously, he's they have to have a nurse, so Nurse Nessie. Yeah. And a Loch Ness Monster.
Right, yeah. They're all there.
They're all there. It's all right. Mm-hmm.
The guy who shot JFK has a paper bag over his head with a question mark on it all the time.
Okay. So we push forward to 1946. The Scandinavian countries all across... Let me try to reword that. Scandinavian countries in 1946 were reporting tons of lights in the sky. Eventually, they would become known as Swedish ghost lights.
Swedish light balls.
Swedish light balls. But it wouldn't be until the summer of 1947 where all those events leading up to Roswell would happen. And so we shift our focus to Roswell, New Mexico. Now, it's funny that there's UFO flaps tend to happen during the summertime. I just want to point that out as well. I know I have this written down. I got to use it. The most active points in Skinwalker Ranch were during the summertime. It seemed to take winter off and not be active during the winter. And it seems similar here where there's a rash of stuff happening in the summer and then it all culminates to one big event and then it all stops and then nobody sees anything anymore. It's very bizarre.
Thinner there.
Yeah, perhaps a flap of some sort.
A flap of some kind. Some sort of thinning of the barrier between worlds.
We have
just
it?
Like at Skinwalker.
Yes, Grand. You're starting available to understand.
$29.99 Lies.
Let's talk a little bit about Roswell, New Mexico, as a whole. Much like when we did Skinwalker, I want to cover a little bit about the geography and history of the area. Roswell, New Mexico, is located in Chavez County, which forms the entirety of the Roswell micropolitan area. It has a population of around 50,000, and the city was officially founded on August 20th, 1873. Roswell's been home to the New Mexico Military Institute since 1891, a four-year high school and two junior high school, junior colleges, whose presence contributed to the New Mexico becoming a state in 1912. In the 1930s, the city was chosen to house Dr. Goddard's rocket experiments, who remained for 12 years and led to Roswell being dubbed, quote, the cradle of space exploration, end quote. And then in 2012, fearless Felix Baumgartner left Roswell Airport in a balloon and floated 39,000-ish meters above the ground, which is around 24 miles or so, to the stratosphere before jumping and returning safely back to Earth. He set the record for the for exit altitude, highest manned balloon flight, and fastest speed of free fall at over 830 miles per hour.
Was that the Red Bull thing?
I think you might be right.
Where he like, it was like live streamed and he like jumped from like, that was amazing.
He was the first human to break the barrier of sound outside of a vehicle.
Yeah, that was like Iron Man shit. That was crazy looking.
Happened in Roswell, baby. Oh, they've got so much stuff that goes for them. However, the city was made famous for the July 1947 UFO crash. However, the crash was more closely located to Corona, New Mexico, at the Foster Sheep Ranch owned by Mac Brazel, the rancher we talked about a little earlier, with another crash happening in the plains of San Agustin, known as the Flats. However, as Corona is a small village with a population of under 200, Roswell was more well-known and had more resources to investigate the crash, and kind of by umbrella and a suction effect, it all kind of became known as one event. The Roswell, New Mexico event. There's a sweet little, like, if you can actually go look, if anybody cares, there's actually a little map you can check out on Wikipedia that shows exactly where the crash sites are in relation to the city, so you kind of know where it all happened. At this point, though, we're going to bump into the timeline of events. We're going to jump into the weeks leading up to the actual sighting now. And we're going to talk a lot about what was being seen, because a lot of it was very much the same. Summer 1947, I would personally consider a UFO flap. And it starts on the 25th of June in 1947. A lot of people just jumped to the crash, but it was actually a dentist by the name of Dr. R.F. Sensenbauer who actually had the very first sighting. Out in Silver City, New Mexico, on a nice evening, the doctor ended up seeing what he described as, quote, a flying saucer-shaped object about one half the size of the moon, unquote.
What?
And it was a saucer-shaped flying object about one half size of the full moon.
Oh, like in the sky. Okay.
In the sky.
I was like, what in the
like how
fuck
he
is
saw
he
it.
Talking about? The
Death
Star
like,
rolling
like
up?
Mothership kind of? Yeah. Like, what? Okay.
It was moving at a relatively high speed to the south of him. One day later, June 26th, 1947, Lexington, Kentucky, another doctor saw something. a doctor by the name of Dr. Leon Oettinger. He saw, quote, a large silver ball-shaped object, clearly not a balloon or dirigible, traveling at high speed near the edge of the Grand Canyon, end quote. So this thing zipped by. Grand Canyon, a lot of UFO sightings out there, by the way. The silver ball-shaped object. Now, what that interests me, because people keep seeing saucers, but a lot of saucers, when they travel by people who see them, they don't actually travel like this, like you see in the movies. A lot of the time what they see is the saucer flips up on it like a 90 degree angle and then moves forward like that, if that makes sense. So it kind of moves up and then its front is like a flat plate moving forward.
Okay.
If that, am I giving you a good visual here?
Like it lands, yes, flat, and then it like stands it, up like a rocket then, ship and takes off straight up into the air.
But it'll do that in the air. It'll do that in the air. We'll just kind of flip onto its side and it'll still travel forward, but it's traveling forward with its, what could be considered the top, now its front.
Yeah. I see. Yeah.
So like it would propel like a helicopter does when it does like the, like it's angled, yeah, down.
But like perfectly 90 degrees, not actually fully angled. Like you can, it just goes whoop and then it moves.
Interesting.
I only say that because he's saying he sees a ball, and I'm just wondering, I'm curious if he saw the front facing part of the object or something along those lines.
It's like Boba Fett's ship. Like it's like,
yeah, kind of more like, sure, Boba Fett's, okay, ship. Yeah. There we go. That's a really good comparison. Yeah, thank you, Star Wars. I don't know why I didn't jump to that.
George Lucas, alien?
What? A star child?
Complete?
I don't think George Lucas is an alien or a star child. I think George Lucas would be the one that like wants to go breed with the aliens.
He's like the Richard Dreyfuss character.
That's why the Twi'leks are so hot.
What? Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what
I mean, yeah. No, you,
oh,
mean,
yeah.
Wrong.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. But just don't question. Like, he made them hot because he loves aliens, dude. That's the point. Anyway, the next day, the 27th of June, 1947, we have 5 sightings all in the same day scattered across a few different places. The first one is Tintown, Arizona. A disc-shaped object overhead zipped by and apparently came down to Earth around 10:30 in the morning. This was reported by John Pesch, who is an electrician. So basically what he ended up seeing is a disc zipped over and then it came down like towards out of sight, but was moving down towards Earth. He believed to be moving toward it. And just
on the 27th?
This is on the 27th.
Okay.
This is like the next day after that. Sighting 2, also Arizona, but this time in Warren. The witness was actually a military man, Major George Wilcox. He saw a series of 8 or 9 perfectly spaced discs traveling at high speed with a wobbling motion. Discs passed over Wilcox's house at 3-second intervals heading east and estimated to be at a height of about 1,000 feet above the mountaintops.
Did these people know each other at all? They weren't close enough to
no.
be... Yeah, okay.
This is all... No. And if to further, we're going to actually move to New Mexico on the same day with a different sighting. So moving even out of Arizona. But this is somebody who has a little bit more credibility than, I guess, an electrician, seeing things zipping over his house. And he, you know, like I said, 1,000 feet over the mountaintops. It's not that high up. I mean, it's high, but not that high. The third sighting would be over in Pope, New Mexico, by a man known as W.C. Dobbs. He simply said, quote, "I saw a white disc glowing like an electric light bulb," unquote. And he said it was passing overhead. So a white disc, again, glowing, but this time glowing. Like a light bulb, I guess.
It really sounds like some people saw something. Like, was this all over the paper, or was this just like reports coming in?
These are all reports coming in. Over the course of the 2 weeks, people are reporting it as they would to, you know, the Air Force base and such, that you would, cops, police.
Right. So these aren't things that are being reported on, right? They're just like...
Correct. These are just reports of. So... Here's the next one. Fourth sighting, White Sands Missile Range. The witness, Captain E.B. Detchmendi. Minutes after the sighting we just talked about, the one above, the W.C. Dobbs one, this one happened, and it was another disc traveling quickly overhead, heading to the southwest of the base. So it zipped over the base in a southwest direction. Last one, sighting 5, San Miguel, New Mexico. Mrs. David Appelzoller. She saw roughly an hour after sighting the fourth sighting, the one we just saw above. I say above because it's in my script. You guys can't see that. But the one we referenced a minute ago, she saw a similar object sighted over the city, also heading southwest. So the question is, if these are to be taken as real, and you don't, we can question them all you want, but is it the same craft that everybody's seeing and it's ripping by across the skies and over these states and just traveling in the same direction? Or is it multiple different things, maybe two different ships or maybe even three? I don't know. How's your feeling on this?
It's so hard to deny like a rash of sightings.
Two military ones in the same day, three civilian ones.
If it's not paper, if it's not like media whipping up a frenzy, like, because that's the thing that really like
that happens the after the crash.
That's what I mean. Like, that's the thing that really takes the wind out of the sails a lot of the time, is that it's like there's a bunch of reports, but it's because like it's getting covered in the paper every night.
Well, I was gonna ask, like, what is the timing on these?
Timing between, what do you mean, like
when people came out and said.
On the 27th, it was 5 in one night.
Yeah.
But did all 5 report it in one, like, that night?
That's a good question. I don't.
That's the biggest concern for me, is that I'm curious. You can say, like, 5 days later, oh, yeah, that night I saw a thing. But I'm curious what the
I know the reports came before the crash. I just don't know if they were that night or during the 2 weeks at some point during, like, exactly when.
Because
I imagine the military ones were reported immediately.
When you say like, oh, it's a, it could be one or it could be many.
Oh yeah, that's. I mean, I don't know.
It's all about like what your point of view is, right?
Yeah. Because
if you want to believe that it's a ship that can move super fast, then it's one thing.
Yes.
But if you're like, well, I don't know, it could be many things. I'm really curious to see what the actual numbers are when it comes.
I will make a note and I'll come back to you with that in episode 2. And I will have that at the top just so I have an idea.
Regardless of what it is, though, I think it's hard to say that something didn't happen that night, especially since 2 of the reports were from military guys, right? Which means they probably were reporting that stuff in. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Well, it's just like when you see modern-day UFOs that are being obviously, they're tracking something.
Yes.
We just don't know what. And I think this is a perfect example of, like, something happened, and nobody – it's been a cover-up so long that it's been so – like, convoluted, we have no clue what actually occurred.
Right. Yeah, and it just, the deeper you dig, the more confusing it gets, which is just so, it's so bizarre. Now we move over to the next day. Only one sighting, 28th of June, 1947, Alamogordo, New Mexico. Captain F. Divin, who was a pilot, saw, quote, a ball of fire with a fiery blue tail behind it, unquote, pass beneath his aircraft, and then it appeared to disintegrate.
Ball of fire with a blue tail
behind it went under his ship and appeared to disintegrate. Could be a meteor, could be something coming in, you know, that to me sounds closer to like a weird meteor or something coming in. Who knows? But something to keep note of. Then 2 more sightings on the 29th of June, 1947, the next day. First one, Cliff, New Mexico. The witness was a bunch of Army Air Force pilots, just a bunch of them. They conducted a search for a fallen object reported to have fallen sometime before noon that day. However, they found nothing, but they were in their report, they reported a strange odor in the air. So they got a report of a strange object that apparently fell, checked it out.
So they went on foot down?
Yeah, they went out there on foot.
Mm-hmm. And they smelled something.
They smelled something, but saw nothing. No physical evidence of a crash. No destroyed trees, no burn marks, none of that stuff.
I hate to say it, but you know what other place is really famous for?
I know.
Skinwalker Ranch, baby.
But, okay, so we'll talk about it again, but we're going to see things that we've talked about before. The idea of you know, if you really want to get weird with it, aliens being a mix of physical and psychic in nature, in that there may be, you know, like they're sightings, but then there's nothing there, and there's a smell, but there's no vehicle, even though the Army was, you know, got pinged of a location.
Right, they're tracking it.
Yeah, it's weird. It's weird. It's just fucking weird.
Who saw the object fall? Pilots.
The previous day, you talking about that particular day?
When they went to go find it, and there was a report
of a fallen object. I'm curious if it was the object prior that day. No, it wouldn't be, because it was the prior day in a different town. So they just got a report.
It just came from a
from their
civilian?
Base. Like, hey, a report of a, it could have come from a civilian. It could have come from one of their scouts. Okay. Who fucking knows?
But they went out on an official.
They went on an official army business.
All right.
The second sighting was by Dr. C.J. Zahn the same day. This was in the White Sands Proving Ground. He simply saw a silver-colored disc that did a series of maneuvers at high altitude over a secret rocket test range. This is also very, very common with UFOs. Nuclear sites, missile sites, UFOs will come by, sometimes do nothing, sometimes do something, and then zip away. Sometimes they, what do you call them? Soldiers say they see them getting scanned. But this is also weird, too. It kind of shows up, does a bunch of weird, jerky maneuvers in the sky, and then takes off. Gone.
That's the thing. There's so many things in this case about, like, flying objects that are, like, maneuvering around.
Yep.
And I just don't see a weather balloon doing that.
And keep in mind, too, this is happening how long after we dropped the A-bomb?
Like 2 years.
This is 1947. Yeah, so we dropped it in 46. Yeah, so 45?
That's a Jesse question. I can't remember.
Jesse, when did we drop the A-bomb in Japan in World War II? Was it 45 or 46?
To end the war? Yeah, 45.
45. So a couple years later, we're looking at after we dropped the A-bomb. And there is an argument that if it is extraterrestrial in nature, they took interest when we started splitting the atom and causing mass destruction. But again, a fun theory for another time. Anyway, that's what they saw on that day. 30th of June, 1947, the next day. Location, Albuquerque, New Mexico. A rail worker by the name of Price saw 13 silvery disc-shaped objects while we're traveling one after another. Initially heading south, they then changed course abruptly and then went east and then reversed dramatically going west before disappearing out of sight.
Like, what is that? Like, what could that be?
I don't know. It's so weird. It's so weird.
That's another official report, right?
That's a railroad worker. This is not a military site.
Right,
this is somebody called it into the police, yeah. You know, blah, blah, blah. I saw this. Sighting two of that day was then in Tucumcari, I think is how you say it. Tucumcari, New Mexico. This was another just civilian, Helen Hardin. She was a Quay County abstract company employee.
Are we on the 30th now?
This is still, this is still the 30th.
Okay.
Sighting two of the 30th. The railroad worker was the 30th. This is also the 30th.
Okay.
She saw a flying saucer from her front porch traveling east to west at high speed, about half the size of the full moon with slight yellow cast. So it was glowing slightly yellow, going east to west, back and forth a bunch.
I wish she saw a lot of them. I wish she saw 13.
Yeah, but remember the general like earlier saw 9.
I know, like maybe they were buzzing the whole.
Not the general, but it's weird. And then we get to the 1st of July, 1947, where we got seven. Okay, so it's three major sightings, but the third one is broken down into 9 because it was the same thing seen by a bunch of people all at once. So first sighting was Albuquerque, New Mexico. This is July 1st, 1947 again. Chamber of Commerce executive Max Hood saw a bluish disc zigzagging across the northwestern sky.
So that's another point for bluish.
Yep, bluish. This one, this time, another government worker.
Yep.
Sighting two, Phoenix, Arizona. So super far away from New Mexico. Witnesses were Mr. and Mrs. Frank Munn. They saw just a large object moving over the east of Phoenix. Just an object kind of going. And then the last one, which are 7 separate reports, all of the same thing, in Mexicali, from Mexicali to Juarez, Mexico, there were just reports of just people, of civilians, seeing flying discs from Mexicali all the way to Juarez. This was in Mexico, mind you, not in New Mexico or the States. This is south, yeah. Further south.
That is crazy, man. Like, I feel like whatever it was, there was probably multiple ones. And they were probably up there in the sky, you know?
Yep.
I don't know what else, but I don't know what else I'm willing to believe, but at least like it's so many different reports.
Yeah, it's insane. And all just kind of going about their day. There's nothing like incredible about these sightings either. A lot of the times, you know, you want to be like, well, I was out on my front porch. This thing landed and communicated with me. But really, these are just like really quick. Like I was walking and thing kind of zipped by and there it goes. Or I was at my base and they kind of did a bunch of dances and went east. And they're just very, very quick things. It's very bizarre. We have one more day of with one more sighting before we actually have to move down to proper Roswell. July 2nd, 1947. This was in proper Roswell, New Mexico. Mr. and Mrs. Dan Wilmot. They claim to have seen a large glowing object as it passed over the home, traveling northwest at a high rate of speed. Again, something so simple, just kind of glowing and going by, right by their house in New Mexico. And that would be the last one of the sightings before the actual incident. And from here on out, there's going to be a lot of characters involved. As I said, this is probably one of the more in-depth ones we're doing. So this is going to be kind of part history, part crazy, hopefully all together and for an enjoyable thing. Because now we got to move into, I want to talk a little bit about the people involved so you understand who these people are when their names come up and just where their positions were within the government at the time. It's not like a huge list of 20 people,
right?
Just about seven or so that are worth noting. We've got W.W. Mac Brazel. This is the foreman at the Forest Ranch. This is the rancher that ended up having the crash happen on his ranch site. So Mac Brazel, rancher.
Is this the Sheriff guy from the picture?
Likely, yes. Yeah. there's also Sheriff George A. Wilcox. He's the sheriff of Chavez County, which is the county Roswell's in. He's the one that ends up responding to the rancher and gets to see the debris first before the U.S. Army gets their hands on it. So it's important to know what he says with that in mind. Frank Joyce is a reporter and announcer for the Roswell radio station KGFL. He interviewed Mac Brazel on the telephone before the military arrived and was later told a different story entirely. We'll go about that as well. Major Jesse A. Marcel, you might recognize the name. We talked about him a little earlier. He's the one, the intelligence office at Roswell Army Airfield, 509th Bomb Group intelligence officer. He picked up the material at the ranch and then later flew with it personally on the Super Fortress from Roswell, New Mexico to Fort Worth, Texas.
He's the same guy who flew with Little Boy?
Little Boy?
Bomb?
Yeah, he didn't fly with the bomb. He just flew personally with the crash debris from Roswell there. Then there's CIC Cavett. He's the counterintelligence officer. He picked up material at the ranch, has since denied any involvement despite multiple eyewitness testimonies putting him at the scenes. We'll talk about that as well. Gerald Anderson claimed to have found wreckage and bodies on the plains of San Augustine. That's the second crash site, but remember, about 120 miles from where Mac Brazel found the wreckage. 6 years old, and this was all 6 years old at the time. He was 6 years old at the time, Gerald. So again, important to keep that in mind when Gerald Anderson talks about what he sees. He was six. Then there's Grady L. Barney Barnett. She claimed to found some wreckage and bodies in the plains of San Augustine as well. Also in the same-ish area, about 120 miles from where Mac Brazel found the wreckage. And then finally, Glenn Davis. He was a mortician for Roswell Army Airfield and claimed to have spoken with a nurse who had seen the alien bodies for herself. However, the nurse remains unidentified, of course. We do not know who that nurse was, nor if we can take that as a point of fact.
So he's just known because of he has this one piece of hearsay.
Correct. That's one of those like, well, he might just be trying to get in on the story, you know, like, well, no, I definitely, the nurse, she saw the aliens, dude. She saw them. She definitely saw them. So we're going to quickly talk a little bit about the actual event, and then we're going to leave the episode off, and we're going to move into episode two soon.
Damn.
Wednesday, July 2nd, 1947, the day of the last sighting that we talked about is actually the very beginning of the Roswell incident. Mr. and Mrs. Dunn Wilmot reported an oval-shaped object moving at an incredibly high rate of speed over their house in Roswell, New Mexico. During a thunderstorm in the Corona, New Mexico area, Mac Brazel heard a thunderclap that sounded like an explosion that he says sounds, quote, much different than thunder, end quote. William Woody also reported that he and his father watched a bright meteor described as white with a red tail streak, across the sky, falling past the horizon out of sight. So this is all in July 2nd, 1947. You kind of take pieces. Each one saw a different thing. Brazel had the clap happen. Mr. and Mrs. Dan Wilmot saw an oval-shaped object fly over their house, just kind of like, whoa, neat. Oval-shaped fits tic-tac shape.
Whoa.
I don't know. What do you think they were saying in 1947 when they saw?
Whoa, wife, bro. Did you see that? In 1947, they were like, yeah. Tubular, my guy.
bodacious, husband, bro. I know, listen, bro. Dude,
this is what happens. I've been in the alien world too long now. I grew the hair. I smoke weed way too much. I'm gone. You can't save
me. Yeah, no, whatever.
Whatever,
wife, bro.
The war is totally just barely over, my dude.
Okay.
Thank God I survived the war to come back to you, wife, bro.
Hitler is freshly buried, bro.
I hate you all. I hate you all.
So tell me, is there actually a theory that you're going to get to that like explains, like in a like sort of like almost like lore way, like how all these people are seeing all these different craft? Is that like
yes? But that's not going to be till much later.
Right, right. But there is that people.
Yeah. Yes, you fool. Not till much later.
Much later.
Please, Alex. Please, we'll get there eventually.
I'm just so fascinated by the situation because, like, conceptualizing it like this, I didn't really realize that it was, like, a bunch of little things that sort of just all happened at once that everybody got involved in altogether. I thought it was more like one thing that happened. Tommy Lee Jones was there.
He was.
He joined the Men in Black, and he had to leave his girlfriend behind.
Here comes the man. He was going to propose. He was going
to
propose.
He brought the flowers and he gave them to the alien instead. It was so sad.
Yeah.
It was sad. It was very sad.
But it's okay because they're all in a marble anyway. The end.
True. Everything means nothing. We're just toys.
Shout outs to my man. What's his name? Nasty Habits. What the hell is his name?
What?
Oingo Boingo? Danny Elfman. There we go.
Danny Elfman? Yeah. Oingo Boingo.
Anyway. We gotta refocus and get through the event, boys.
My question for you is
sorry.
Just so everyone understands what's going on.
Yes.
Leading up to this moment,
yes.
There are numerous sightings
over days, weeks.
Over days. It is post World War II.
Yep.
We've dropped two atomic weapons. We are in sort of a post-war but introducing the space race concept.
It's a huge
Nazi
time.
Scientists
huge
have been recruited to join NASA. Like, I mean, that's pretty much what's going on, right? Like, there's
pretty much,
You know, early NASA was a lot of Nazi rocket scientists.
It really was.
Paperclip.
We'll talk about that definitely one day. Paperclip is huge.
But
all of these
things are like happening right now. It's like there's a lot of
excitement, buzz,
mystique on the government level. There's like a mystery. Like, there's a lot going on. As the world sort of reordering and restructuring itself, because those of you who don't know, also a lot of the countries that exist currently today were formed post World War II.
Yep,
like a lot of the world was restructured and reshaped.
Yeah.
After the end of that war,
it's very different, which is I find very very interesting in this UFO context specifically. So that was July 2nd. The husband and wife saw the object. Brancher heard a bang. And then somebody reported seeing the bright object in the sky descend past the horizon. It's then the next day, on the 3rd of July, that due to the rain the night before, Mac Brazel actually could not go outside and check what happened in his fields where he heard the noise. So it was the next day that he was able to go outside and inspect his fields. And it was there that he found what he claims is in the rain-soaked pasture past the sheep. He found scattered across the fields extending from the top of a small circle on the hills, ran down the Arroyo dried riverbed, up another hill, and disappeared into the riverside. Reports say 3/4 mile long, the 200-foot wide, with a gouge starting at the north end, extending 400 or 500 feet toward the other end. There, the debris lied. It was so thick on the ground that the sheep couldn't actually even cross over it and had to be driven an extra mile to water. That gash in the ground was so big, the sheep couldn't get around it.
How the fuck big was the craft? What was going on? Why did
a weather balloon, man? It's just a weather balloon. What are you talking about? Weather balloon came down. It just fucking annihilated the ground for 3/4 mile.
What are those things called? Ronsons? How big are they even?
Not that big. You can look at it.
As big as a person. Like, it's not like I could fit that inside my body.
Yeah, it's nuts. Not thinking much of it, however, and being the rancher that he was, Brazel decided to, for the shit of it, take some of the debris home and actually share it with some of his neighbors, Floyd and Loretta Proctor. The material they tried and they claimed. They sat at the table and they played with it, experimented with it. It was fascinating to them. And they claimed no matter how hard they tried, and they tried, this material could not be burned or cut.
Yeah, I remember some old TV show or something about this where he was saying he was trying to crinkle it up and he could, and no matter what he would do, he'd like put it back and it would just not be wrinkled again.
Yep. It was always perfectly smooth, yet very malleable and flexible. They would try and tear it, they would try and burn it, and nothing would happen. They'd take scissors to it and a knife to it, and they couldn't cut it. But it could still be moved and flexible.
That's crazy.
Now imagine if that's what if this is a UFO, that's what the UFOs are made out of. I mean, it would explain like how easily they can move.
It's like James Cameron shit.
Yeah, really, it's wild. 3 days later, Brazel drove the 75 miles into Roswell proper. He stopped at the office of Sheriff George A. Wilcox, and Wilcox suggested that he call the military after he told him of what he found and what happened. While they were waiting for the military officers to arrive, Wilcox ended up dispatching two deputies to the ranch. Frank Joyce said that he called the sheriff and asked if there was anything interesting happening at the office, and Wilcox told him that he should interview Brazel while he was there. Colonel Blanchard, commander of the 509th Bomb Group, Major Jesse A. Marcel, and the counterintelligence officer Cavett responded to the sheriff's call when he let them know of the crash and the materials that the rancher claimed to have found. The officers interviewed Brazel, examined some pieces of the material, and then Blanchard ordered Marcel and Cavett to accompany Brazel back to the ranch. So basically, he drove into Roswell with this stuff. He's like, hey, Sheriff, this shit happened, and he landed over. He's like, call the military. And so he called the military, and while they were there, he called over some of his other officers, and they kind of checked out the stuff. And then eventually the military showed up and then decided to take it and escort him back to the ranch.
Would you really take something like that if you were the military, if you didn't immediately know what it was?
That's a good question. I don't know what standard procedure would be. I mean, there's context to it, right? Like,
I think during this time period,
yeah,
you would. Because if you recall, they just came out of the militarization of the nation, right? Like, the reason why America did so well in World War II is because when the time came that we were like, all right, we're actually going to fight now after Pearl Harbor, like, the entire nation was like, your cars are now tanks. You're this thing. Like, everything you do is for the war effort. America has never been like that since. So I think we don't have the context for why people would trust the military as much as they did in the 40s, which was like, yeah, we're all in this together. And like, good old Uncle Sam will look out for us, and we got to watch out for G.I. Joe. Like, all this shit.
We're like booming.
Contextually.
That makes sense. Yeah. I'll buy that. Yeah.
Now we're like, nah, man, F that.
It just seems crazy that there would be like a mysterious substance and that an officer would be like, pack it up. You know what I mean? Like, that seems crazy.
Yeah, but I mean, it's tough. It's so tough because, like Jesse said, the late 40s, this is just a time of mystery for the government, too. So they're probably just like, put a lid on it.
And that's what's messed up is it's a time period where the public is like, we love the military. Yeah. Our boys in, I won't say boys in blue. Yeah. That's not true.
It's not.
Our boys in whatever color uniform they're wearing. But at the same time, it's also when the government's doing some really messed up, like, secret op shit.
Oh, yeah.
And the Cold War is kicking off and, like, it is... Everyone that, everyone from Hoover on up, like, it is, it's all bad news.
Yeah.
So
it's unfortunate. And it makes it difficult when you want to know things like this shit.
Yep.
So moving forward, Colonel Blanchard, after that, this is after he sent back the rancher with his escort guard, I guess, back to 75 miles back to his ranch. Blanchard alerted the military headquarters of what he found or what was brought out. Acting on the orders from General Clements McMullen, passed to him by Colonel Thomas DeBose, they sealed some of that material that the rancher Brazel had brought to the sheriff's office. The material was then flown onto Fort Worth Army Airfield. Not the big super fortress one. This is just the piece of material that he brought. It was immediately brought to Fort Worth.
This is just a little proof of concept.
Yep. And remember, he and the rancher had this material for about three or four days. He played with it for like 3 or 4 days.
Around, yeah.
Yeah, him and the neighbors, they were literally playing with it. It's what they did with it.
That's the other thing that's weird about this is they're like, we don't know where it is, or they didn't know that it existed. Because you'd think if it was like a craft, that you lost that you would just go get it the same day because you probably know exactly where it is, right?
Yeah, if this is like a U.S. test craft with a pilot inside and it gets annihilated, why did it take him driving into Roswell?
Like a beacon or something in there?
Well, but there is some interesting theories that we'll talk about that they could be another country's, the Cold War, Russia, a test vehicle of theirs that ended up crashing.
I heard some crazy theory one time about it being like a hoax from Russia.
Yep, there's a theory that they literally took a craft. We'll talk about this in episode 3 way deeper and why people kind of take it a little seriously, but yeah. And they filled it with physically deformed and mentally impaired children and sent it to crash, and that hoping that they would mistake the bodies of those physically deformed and mentally impaired children as aliens.
That just seems so fucked up to me. Like, how could that be the plan? Like, how?
And how is there any way that you can guarantee that whoever sees them is going to go aliens?
I mean,
I heard that potentially the plan, if that was the case, mm-hmm. like one of the reasoning behind it was like a lot of the reasoning behind a lot of the Russia stuff is like, it's the Cold War. The Cold War is just starting, and it's Russia saying we can do whatever we want on your soil.
And the
justification is America's supposed to be like, we have to cover this up. We don't want people to know, which, you know, seems very, you know, like spy movie-y, which I think, you know, who knows if that's real or not.
Yeah,
but it makes sense in like a noir film kind of way that we have to cover it up. They're on American soil. You
know. Yeah. I mean, it's an easier way to swallow it if you want to go that angle, for sure. After the military officers left alongside with Brazel to escort him, the two deputies returned. Remember, the sheriff sent out two deputies to check out the crash site with the debris. They came back after the military left with the rancher, and they reported to have found no debris in the debris field, but they did find a burned area in one of the pastures. The sand had been turned to glass and blackened.
Glass
it looked as if something...
Sand? How hot does it have to be to glass sand?
And they said it looked as if something circular had touched down. Now, remember, these are the deputies that the sheriff sent out.
3,200 degrees.
That's insane.
To glass sand.
And there's no debris. It's gone. The debris is gone.
That's so
at least
hot.
As far as they saw. Yeah, and it's all burned down. The aircraft from Roswell was met at the Fort Worth Army Airfield by DeBose and Colonel Alan Clark. Clark received the plastic bag with the debris and walked to the command, B-26 to fly it onto Washington, D.C. and General McMullen. So they literally brought this thing to Fort Worth, Texas in a baggie, handed it off, and now it's being flown to D.C.
Immediately to D.C. because they're like, it's a weather
balloon.
Off.
Goodbye. Yeah. See ya. Off to D.C. it goes.
No one was like, do you guys have anything silver and disc shaped that you guys sent out? That we need to worry about?
Yeah, is there some secret tech going on?
It just doesn't make logical sense to me totally.
Honestly, weather balloon, I don't buy it. But again, we'll talk about more of the evidence. Anyway, because the trip back to the ranch was 75 miles and it was so dark, Brazel, Marcel and Cavett being the two people from the military, arrived after dark and they just ended up staying the night. They just spent the night there. Going on to the next day, Monday the 7th, 1940s. Yeah, they stayed at the ranch overnight.
Weird, okay.
Yeah. But that means the next day, Brazel was able to take them both out to the field where he found the debris. Marcel and Cavett walked the perimeter of the field and then ranged out looking for more debris or another crash site maybe that was in the area, but ended up finding nothing. Finally, they returned and spent the remainder of their day collecting what debris they still could. They loaded the rear of Marcel's 1942 Buick convertible, as well as the Jeep carryall driven by Cavett, and left the field around dusk. So, while they weren't able to find any debris, what ended up happening is the rancher took a lot of the debris beforehand during those 3 days, and he moved it into his giant barn. And that's where most of it was. So they took what they could out of there, and they loaded up the trucks with what debris they had, and they left. The next day, Marcel stopped by his house on the way to the base. He awakened his wife and son to show them the material he had. They spent an hour examining this thing, scattered all on the kitchen floor. After, Marcel collected it all, loaded it into the car, and drove to the base. He took a detour with this shit, woke up his family, and just was like, hey guys, wanna see something cool? And he just fucking put it out there. And then a kid and a wife played with it for an hour.
I don't understand. Like, what could this have been? Why do we know that?
All the interviews. The investigative journalists over the years hunted these people down and just got stories from them in their older years.
What lands that the government doesn't come looking for almost 5 days that they immediately fly to Washington, D.C., and also the guy was so excited about that he showed it to his wife? You wouldn't show, like, a spy craft to your wife.
Yeah.
You wouldn't show, like, a piece of balloon to your wife.
Maybe. I don't know. You don't know what... I mean, you...
Like, I wouldn't show a spy craft to my wife because I'd be worried that I'd take a bullet for it. You know what I mean? Like, a spy, it's like, oh, this is dangerous. I don't know about
it. It's all loosey-goosey, right?
Yeah.
It feels all very loosey-goosey, right? Yeah, nobody seems to be giving a shit. Everybody's sharing it with everybody else. Everybody's like, look how cool this shit is. But it's right after that, that Marcel and Cavett visited with Blanchard, the other military guy that they've been talking to, in his quarters, telling him what they'd seen with the material and so on. Blanchard then called the provost marshal, Major Edwin Easley. Blanchard ordered Easley to post guards on the roads around the crash site, denying all access to anyone without official business. Blanchard also ordered Easley to find Brazel and have him escort the MPs to the site. Blanchard also called the 8th Air Force headquarters and advised them that Marcel had returned with more debris. The 8th Air Force headquarters in Fort Worth relayed Blanchard's message up the chain of command, alerting the Pentagon about the material. A special flight from Andrews was granted from men coming from the Pentagon. And that's when we can say the government, in a weird way and officially, put a lid on Roswell. It's at that moment they blocked everything up. They stopped people from going in, going out, and everybody was beginning to get new orders to change their stories. And that is where we're going to leave Roswell Part 1 off.
What in the hell, man? It just doesn't feel... I don't hear it and feel like, oh, this is nothing. Like, a lot, sometimes you read about a thing and you're like, this is definitely an interesting little story, but, like, if I'm thinking about this, it's easily made up by one guy. You know?
Yep.
This doesn't have that tang to it.
The fun stuff isn't even happening yet, boys. I'm just saying.
The issue with Roswell, as far as I can see, is that there have been so many interviews conducted over years and years and years and years that the story we have now is like the extrapolation of all those interviews put together.
Yes, it's very much like taking different puzzle pieces and just trying to.
And that's why there's parts of it that you're like, wait, what? Like, wait, what? Because there's certain things that don't make sense across the board, but it's because it's been, what, 70, 60 years now?
Something around those lines, yeah. And we just passed an anniversary of Roswell, actually, a few days ago.
And it's one of those things where so many people have added to the story or had deathbed confessions or said different things that it there's a lot of convolution as well. I don't know. I mean, there are some things where I'm like, oh, well, that could totally be a real thing. But at the same time, I'm like, this guy is clearly a plant, right? There's like weird things in this story that do not check out. And it is, the deeper we get, the more it's like, wait a minute, what is this?
We're going to talk, like, I'll give you a peek in the next episode. We're going to really talk heavily about the wreckage and the material itself, and apparently the claims of symbols that were seen along the edges of it. All that stuff is in Wacky Town, but we'll talk a little bit more about that because we're going to learn about the MJ-12 and all that next episode.
And let's take a minute to realize the importance of the fact that at its core, what Roswell is saying is that if...
Yes.
These are aliens. If. Big Jesse if. If these are aliens. The story here is that post-atomic weapon usage, aliens started to appear on Earth as like, we know you guys are about to enter a new age. We're here to do this whole like, make sure you're on the up and up. But aliens that can travel across however you think aliens travel, dimensions or space and time or whatever, they just, like, crash. Like, an alien ship just crashed. Like, it seems insane. Like, there's so much to this. An alien ship, imagine, like, we made it across the galaxy and we crashed in a field.
Well,
like,
Jesse,
it doesn't,
what if I told you that it didn't necessarily crash by malfunctioning?
Oh, shit.
But we were tracking it and shot it down out of the sky.
Oh, shit.
Then why aren't we destroyed? Why aren't we as a world destroyed?
Well, We'll talk about that because
unless, oh my God, this is all the Matrix. What and if, they did destroy.
I mean,
us,
honestly, what if we mean so tubes. Very little? Like we're just like an ant. It's like an ant biting us.
Isn't that the plot you know of I mean? Saints Row? Doesn't that happen?
Actually, yes,
I think
it does.
Saints Row 4, yeah. Where like aliens invade and put us in the Matrix. You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. That is the plot of Saints Row 4. Yeah, aliens invade. And
disclosure
put us in the
has been happening in all mediums of entertainment. Everybody. I hope you enjoyed part one of Roswell. I am so excited to dive into this 3 or 4-parter. I don't know what it's going to be, but this has been, I'm so excited to keep going. Thank you all so much for listening. As always, if you want and you've been listening and you want to leave us a good review or a review where you listen, it does a lot to keep us kind of at the top and where people finding us and discovering us. We're at over 1,200 reviews on iTunes now. Maintaining that 5-star average. We constantly crack into the top 10 improv. Comedy.
Improv comedy.
Yeah, we do. We're in the top 10 podcasts.
Is there not
improv.
A paranormal podcast?
There is not, but we do crack into the top 50 true crime podcasts regularly as well.
We should be number one paranormal podcast.
There's no paranormal like.
There should be.
Are they saying that it's not real? Because I tend to agree.
So we're comedy. We're a comedy podcast.
Gotcha. Who are we slam dunking
ourselves?
Right now?
And we're slam dunking ourselves and all those on Patreon who gives us their money. Thank you so much. We're going to go record in a minisode. If you want to reach out to us, you can do so on Twitter. I'm at Mathis Games, Alex at Fossian AA, Jesse's at Jesse Cox, and the podcast at Chew Illuminated Pod. Same thing on the Reddit. God, Jesse, you have so many dreams. I'm so ready to have you dream interpret next time we do a fan
stuff. Oh, boy.
It's going to be great, but we're out of here. Goodbye, everybody. We'll see you next week.
Patreon.com/ChewIlluminatedPod.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Do you love true crime podcasts and true crime documentaries?
If so, you gotta check out our podcast, True Crime Obsessed, where we recap the true crime documentaries everybody's watching.
We say everything you're thinking and probably screaming at your TV.
We've been at the top of the podcast charts for almost 9 years, and we have over 400 episodes for you to check out right now.
We cover the cases everyone's talking about, and we also highlight the cases that have been underreported, overlooked, or forgotten.
With over 30,000 5-star reviews on Apple Podcasts, if you've never checked out True Crime Obsessed, now's the time to give us a try.
Find True Crime Obsessed wherever you get your podcasts.